originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Tonight's guest first appeared on this show April 12th, 2017, just as he was beginning his training career. Since going out on his own, the 34-year-old native of Lexington, Kentucky, has now saddled 81 winners, including six already through the first 29 days of 2020. And to make things even better, as part of this whole story of our guest tonight, this past Saturday, he will be forever referred to as a greatest stakes winning trainer because of what happened this past Saturday. Pretty special stuff. Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, coming to you once again from our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios, and happy to have all of you with me for the next hour as you tune in throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and streaming us worldwide on our website at horseracingradio.net. And for those of you tuned into the podcast of this program afterwards, we appreciate you doing that as well, and happy to have you along for the ride. Please join me in welcoming back to Trainer Talk here tonight, Kent Sweezy, our special guest for the next hour. Kent, thanks for taking the time, my friend.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. How are you guys doing?
Things are good. And, you know, it's interesting because I mentioned that you will be forever known now as a graded stakes winning trainer. And I know you have bigger aspirations up the road, but it was a big deal this past Saturday. You sent out Fat Man, the son of Munnings, to win the Fred Hooper Stakes at Gulfstream Park, a grade three. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was a big weekend for us, and we just kind of got him back to Tampa the next day, and he's come back to track now. Today was his first day back, and he's moving good, looks well, and I think we're hopefully going to have a pretty fun spring with him.
You know, they say winning any race is special, and I know I've been on the other side of that as an owner, and I would tell you that winning a maiden race is exciting as anything, but it has to go to a little different level when you win a grade of stakes, doesn't it?
It does, I think. I mean, I think it's my first one that we've won, but I think there's just something about it. I've had a lot more people that have said something along the lines of, you know, it's really tough to win a graded stake, and it's, you know, it somewhat puts us in an elite category, I suppose. But no, I think for us just getting started, and we had a lot of success up at Monmouth this year, and so hoping that carries over into down here. But although down here we try to focus on up there. So when we do win down here, it's just an added bonus for us. And so far we've had a good meet at Gulfstream, and this horse really picked everybody's head up. And so I think we're kind of gearing up and have a couple more to run down here, and then sort of gear up for Monmouth and the spring and summer up there.
Kind of ironic that you'd win a horse race with a horse named Fat Man, isn't it?
Yeah. When you say that, the lady that when we were at the sale, we were going through, and you know, names don't often mean much, you know, unless they're a good horse. And a lot of horses have really good names that can't run, and have bad names that can. So it's when we were looking to, I think I sent the lady maybe a list of 15 or 20 horses, and I think right away she came right back with, "Oh, I'd love to own a horse called Fat Man."
who dreams of owning a horse named Fat Man?
Yeah, and he's the biggest horse in the barn, and he's kind of turned into the big horse in more ways than one, you know.
Where did you end up watching the race on Saturday?
Right outside. I had a bunch of people with me. You know, we had, I guess, there's about 5 or 6 different people that owned the horse, myself included. And it's tough to wiggle your way around on Pegasus Day. And so I think we probably just, like, gave the jock a leg up, walked out, and said, well, let's just watch it right here. We had a nice table inside that they gave us for having a horse and a stake. And but we just said, you know what, let's just watch it kind of amongst all the people. And if something were to happen, it's even more exciting. You know, you'd hate to win a race sitting upstairs by yourself. So it's kind of fun. Everybody's cheering for the horse, and not just us. There were people around us as we were sitting there. People were saying, "Come on, fat man," you know, before they're going to the gate. That was kind of cool. So
yeah, by the way, we should point out that it's not F-A-T. It's P-H-A-T is how that name is spelled.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Was F-A-T already taken?
I'm not sure. You know, we bought him. So I'm not sure how Brad Grady decided to name him. But when we bought him, he came with that name.
When did you know you had the race won?
I don't know. I'd say about the 16th pole, maybe the 8th pole when he was, you know, there were three of them across the track, and it looked like he was the one that was just had the most gas left, I guess. They went really quick up front, and I think they did kind of stagger home, but I think any racehorse would stagger home when you have to chase a 22:44 going a mile. I don't blame him one bit. And yeah, it was just, you know, I still thought, I said, don't let that horse come back on the inside. Don't let him come back on the inside. And sure enough, he held on. He's got a massive stride. We were talking after the race that a big horse, you know, they said about Secretariat having whatever, however big of a heart he had, and that if that's what made him good, or if just sheer ability, and it was just chance he had a big heart. But, you know, when you do have a big horse like this, I mean, I'm looking at him right now, and he takes up the whole doorway. And you have to think that a horse like that he's got real good bones, so that's going to hopefully keep him sound. He's got big lungs, and he breathes well. You know, I think those are two things especially. If you got those big lungs, you also have to functionally do it the right way, and he does. So, I don't know. I'm curious to see how he comes back and breathes back after the race and to see where we go next. But I'm thinking, you know, he did us right this time, so there's no reason to rush him back if you don't have to.
How old is he? Is he six?
Six, yeah.
Wow, he just keeps getting better with age.
I mean, I've only known the horse for 6 or 8 months. You know, we bought him in July, so I know him very well now. But going into it, I didn't know what to expect. And we, anytime you buy a horse at a racing sale, it's tough because you're almost looking for why they're trying to sell him. You know, are we missing something? Did they do something we're not going to do? That's kind of stuff that crosses your mind. And with him, I talked to Joe Sharp. Joe Sharp's my buddy. I've known him forever. And he said that the horse was fine. He gave me the okay on him, you know, and I thought that was, he just gave me a thumbs up, you know, just enough to where you say you're not going to get yourself in any major jackpots. And, you know, we came out, I didn't really breeze him very hard when we first got him because I see him and how he does this and how he does that. And I thought, well, let's just hope he's just better than the rest of them. And we'll just, you know, run him in this little allowance race at Delaware. And then we brought him back in a stake. And you think, well, maybe just a change of scenery, maybe the easier company might help him out. And you never know. A lot of times, especially older horses, I think they've been around the block. They're a lot smarter than these younger horses that come in. And maybe taking care of himself mixed with what we're doing with him and just the fact that he's happy again, I guess that's what's making him tick, I guess, right now.
What attributes did you see in him that made you want to go to Joe and say, hey, you know, I'm looking at buying this horse. What do you think?
Well, to be honest with you, you know, when the book comes out, the first thing I do is go look through the PPs. You know, I scroll through the entire PPs of these racehorses sale, and I think, which ones would I want to train? And about half of them, I'm going to say, are way too far out of my budget. And the other ones are going to be $5,000 horses that we're not looking for. You know, so there was about 20 of them that just fit. And so you do a little bit of research. You watch some replays. Basic Tipton does a great job with putting out a really good website about a month before, so you've got all your rag numbers, whatever numbers you like, whatever thing you like to read, they've got it on there. And if you like video replays, they've got the links to the videos. You know, it's a really easy way to promote a horse, because if I then have to call these people and say, hey, go look up the fifth race on Friday at Lone Star, they're going to say, well, how the heck do I do that? Where with a good website, boom, boom, you just click and you find it. So that helped. And then I can send horses to owners and say, you know, here's 10 horses we really like, and that, you know, we think they're going to fit this level. And again, I said to myself the other day about how when you buy a horse, you often want to look and see especially when you claim one, you always want to have a race in mind when you claim it. So when you buy one, you think the same thing. You might dream a little bit, think, oh, we're going to get him for 60. No way he's going to win a graded stake for us. But it worked out that way. And but, you know, we thought the older horse division, that there are lots of options up where we go in Monmouth. You know, turf racing's tough. It's really, really hard racing, difficult racing. Dirt racing often has smaller fields. We have all those options around where we go in Monmouth, PA, Laurel, you know, Delaware, New York even. So we have lots of places that we can go pick and choose spots. And, you know, I don't think we were looking. This wasn't our – maybe it was our goal, but by no means an expectation. And So, you know, that's where you enter a couple and maybe you scratch out of a race. Oh, I don't like that spot. Or that's the beauty of being in a stakes race. You can scratch with no penalty. So we did. We nominated to some cool spots and entered a couple. But I think just the fact that he was an older horse that wanted to go, you know, a little bit of a route of ground, and he was dirt, that was a huge part of it. So that was kind of where what angle we took there.
Yeah, talking with trainer Kent Sweezy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kent, you gave a leg up to jockey Irad Ortiz Jr., the champion jockey again this year. And when you look at the other trainers that were in that race, the Fred Hooper, Todd Pletcher, Dale Romans, Bill Mott, Chad Brown, Barkley Tagg, how did you end up getting Irad Ortiz to ride your horse?
Yeah, oddly enough, we kind of stumbled on him in the Harlan's Holiday. And it seemed like he got a lot of run out of him, that he's the kind of horse that might need not necessarily an aggressive ride, but one to just stay and keep him on task. And Irad fit him really good. And so going into this race, after he ran second in the Harlan's Holiday, I texted with Jay Rushing and just said, listen, if we ever had a chance to get Irad, I'd love to get him locked up for a race on Pegasus Day. So he said, well, let me work on it like they always do. And then when he called me and said, well, I think Baffert might be thinking about running one of his horses in there, and I kind of assumed it might have been Mucho Gusto. So if Bob chose not to go to the Pegasus, he probably would have run in the undercard race, well, our race, the Fred Hooper. So obviously, Irad would have been had to go with Mucho Gusto. So it actually just worked out really well, and you know, I'm glad we kind of chose to stay home a little bit because it's an easy ship for him. 4 hours is nothing, it worked out great. And I said earlier that I think wherever we go next, it'll have a lot of influence on where Irad goes. If Irad can ride us in one of these undercard races again, like for these big prep for the Derby races, then that would be great. And I think at this point we have lots of options, so we shouldn't settle for something that we don't really like. It doesn't really suit him, you know.
Todd Pletcher was on fire Saturday. He seemed unbeatable. We know how good Chad Brown is. We know Bill Mott and all of, you know, his Hall of Fame credentials. How cool is it for you, Kent, to be able to say, hey, I beat those guys in the greatest stakes?
Yeah, I think it was probably more special early on when I first got started. I think I won a maiden 40 up in New York at Belmont. And it was a small field. It scratched down to a couple. But one of them was Kristoff. And I used to work for Kristoff. And I used to it would have never in my wildest dreams I would have thought that I'd beat Kristoff at Belmont Park. You know, that working for him, he was the man at Belmont, and I didn't think I'd ever be able to touch him. And it was really cool to win a race, and he was the first one to come congratulate me. And so anyway, getting back to your question, I think it's really cool. And a lot of people that were looking, you know, I hope that we can get better horses down the road, and winning races like this on big days, maybe it shows that we can compete, that what we're doing is the same as the other guys, you'd like to think. And so yeah, it was really cool. My mom was the first person. She sent me a screenshot of the first four finishers, and it was pretty cool seeing my name ahead of those guys. I wish it happened more.
Well, let me throw these names at you then too, Kent. I went back and looked through the previous runnings of the Fred W. Hooper, and it's a pretty historic race, really. You go back and you see names like Woody Stevens, who won it a couple of times, Frankie Brothers, yeah. Bill Mott, Carl Nasker, Nick Zito won it three times, Todd Pletcher, and now Kent Sweezy. How cool is that?
It's got a good ring to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of like, wait, which of these doesn't fit quite yet, right? That's not an insult.
Easy.
But no, hey, they're in the Hall of Fame. Maybe one day we're talking about Kent Sweezy there too, and hey, why not, right?
I wonder if that race was always run at that distance, if they switched it around.
It's been changed around.
Two-turn.
Yeah, it's been changed around. Yeah. Of course, it was at Calder for some time, and now with Calder no longer racing, they're back over at Gulfstream with this race. But it's such a cool thing to have your name next to those legends, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. It definitely is. We're very lucky.
Yeah. When you went out on your own, it was 2007, I guess, or 2017.
17, maybe, yeah.
When you went out on your own, what were some of the things that you said, okay, this is what I want to accomplish in the first few years of training on my own?
I wanted to be able to have a business that runs, that we have employees, and the employees get paid on time, and that we train for people that are going to pay us, that they run with dignity, and that they're, you know, we try to keep a real clean shed row and a clean record. And I think if looking back, if I could have said that I'm where I would not have imagined that I was that I've got 40-something horses right now like I do. It's just, I think it's great, but at the same time, we worked really hard when we had 4 or 5, and when we had 10 or 12, we worked just as hard, and now we work probably even harder. It's definitely harder on me than it was when we had 5 or 6. That was pretty easy. You know, you didn't have, if you only have 5 or 6, you don't have many horses that are, say, bleeders, or you don't have many that might need to work on their feet or different things that different horses might need. When you only have a small sample, you don't get to see as much as you would if, when I was working for Jimmy, you had things pop up every day. I mean, you had a filly they might tie up, or maybe one racked it up in the gates, or needed to be paddock schooled, or needed to be reshod. I mean, there's always something in a bigger barn that you have to stay on top of. And so luckily we've got some really good guys. I got a real good foreman and a good assistant that help me with all that, and they can help me manage it. You have to delegate a little bit, or else you miss some of the more important things. And so it all just depends on who you've got working for you and how you can do it. But we're lucky to have a good crew.
Yeah, you mentioned some prominent names in the training ranks. Christophe Clement, Jimmy Jerkins, Owen Hardy, all people you had the privilege to work with and be around and kind of absorb their knowledge before you went out on your own. So you learned a lot of lessons working with them, but what's the most important lesson that you've learned since being out as Kent Sweezy?
Communication, probably. The horses, they all have 4 legs. They're horses. It's taking care of livestock, you know, in that regard, and making sure the horses are as healthy as they can be. And it's a little bit like coaching, maybe. You have to ease certain players along differently than you might. You know, John Calipari, I'm a Kentucky fan, he can drill on those players. Man, they can take some abuse. But some of the other guys that don't make the program, they might not have been able to put up with that. It's similar to horse training, I think, in that some 2-year-olds, man, they just walk right on. You know, you never turn a hair. They don't have shins. They don't go backwards on you. They stay in the feed tub. And then you get horses that you just look at them the wrong way and they kind of fall apart on you. So it's important that, just like a basketball coach, what players you need to hold on to and start when they're a junior. You know, get them a little bit of playing time early, but start them when they're a junior. And then you've got these phenoms that are just freaks. And I haven't had one yet. I'd love if one came along. But one that just does everything and works bullets and comes back and not blowing and does all the things you want to see in a horse and looks the right way and acts the right way, things like that. So I think that's hopefully we can get our hands on a couple of them down the road. But yeah, they're all different. I think that's probably the most important lesson, was just that let every horse tell you what they're going to do, and keep the barn and try to. Jimmy always said, Christophe was big on not talking to clients while he's training, because he put so much into it mentally. And Jimmy is a little bit the same way. Like, that's, the horses always come first, and you talk to owners in the afternoon, you know. So it's a kind of a good lesson. As long as you just keep in contact with these people, they you know, they're not going to call you out of sorts, out of different times, you know. And I train for really good people that know how hard we work. I mean, they've been to the barn at 7:30 in the morning. They know we're full steam ahead at 7:30 in the morning. Last thing I need to do is be sitting down talking to somebody about, you know, one of the horses, and we can talk later. Let's focus on what's important right now. And we try to do that a little bit. I think it's communicating with your owner is probably the most important thing, I would say. And the most important lesson that we've learned.
What do you think you've done the best with so far, Kent? The one thing that you could hang your hat on and say, you know what, as an organization, as an operation, as a business, we do this really well.
I think I think communication is really important. We win races, you know, we do win races. We do that quite a bit, but I think that's worth training. You know, you're going to get that, and it's what you do with it from there. So, to hang our hat on, I think we train for really, really, really good people. Like, not, I don't just mean like my pals. I've got some people that I train for that are my buddies. But I also train for some really, they're businessmen, they're businesswomen, they're head of companies, they run firms and things like that. So it's kind of a feather in our cap that these people that deal with very well-educated, intelligent people on a daily basis, that they have the faith to give us some horses to train. I've got a couple horses for a lot of people. You know, I've got 2 or 3 horses for this guy, 2 or 3 horses for that guy. And I'm involved in a lot of the horses that we've got. I've got a quarter of maybe 10 of them. And that we just, you know, those are kind of the claimers, and maybe some horses that we buy as yearlings to hope to develop. We did a lot of sending horses to different states for the state bred programs. Jersey won, most importantly, the Jersey bred program for us is huge. Then you get Delaware certified, Virginia bred. It's just bonus after bonus of good money, good purses. So it that kind of diversifies a little bit. So yeah, I think we've, for the couple of years we've been going, it's been really, really good, and we've been lucky.
Yeah, and there's always going to be things that you look back on and you say, you know, this is something that maybe we could have done a little differently or along those lines. So when you think back to the past 3 years, what mm-hmm. might be the one thing that you say, you know, if I could rewind the clock and go back and do this differently, this would be one thing I'd like to do differently?
Probably I made a mistake in going to Kentucky. I made a mistake in thinking Kentucky was where I wanted to be, needed to be. It was selfish on my part because I wanted to be at home. I wanted to train in Kentucky. I thought that was where I was going to be. And so I went back there for the first year. I don't think it definitely didn't hurt us, but it was a mistake. I think we could have gone elsewhere and gotten a foot in the door someplace a little bit sooner. One thing I'm glad I didn't do is try to go to New York. That would have been over my head, way over my head. You know, I didn't have the horses to go to Kentucky. There'd be no way I would have been able to get down to the horses to go to New York. That just doesn't make sense for me right now. I love Monmouth. Monmouth really treated us well and got us a chance to sort of broaden the places that we run. When you're in Kentucky, sometimes you're pigeonholed into running in Indiana, Kentucky, you know, maybe Chicago. I've got six condition books on my desk. When we get back to Monmouth, you know, and it's staying on top of it and entries every day and the logistics. You know, the guys that are at, say, Fair Hill, like a Grand Motion, for example, those guys, when they run a horse, they have to pack a trunk every time they go to leave. You know, a lot of people, they underestimate how much work goes into to the coordination of getting a horse from Fair Hill to, say, Belmont. You know, the van driver, who's going to saddle it, how's it going to, the groom, this and that. So that's a challenge we meet when we're up in Monmouth. We try to obviously focus on running at Monmouth, but when something doesn't come up, it's nice having that option, you know.
Yeah, you know, people don't realize, and I hope that listening to this program over the last 8 years or so, people start to get a sense of what trainers go through, not just seeing them in the afternoon saddling their horses and celebrating in the winner's circle, but there is so much that goes on behind the scenes that has to go right to make you successful, isn't there, Kent?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure, and that's just not including the disappointments. What do they say? A Hall of Fame trainer loses 80% of the time.
Yeah.
That means if I run 10 horses, I'm going to get in my car and be upset 8 out of 10 times that my horse didn't run better, you know, and that's a weird thing to do. Not many people have a job that has so much disappointment behind it because you just can't win every race. They're not machines, they're animals. So you get down on your luck a little bit, this and that. And I think all it takes is one good weekend or one good afternoon or a good ride even. If you just get a real good ride, sometimes that's all it takes to kind of kick in the butt and get you going again.
A few weeks ago.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's tough. A lot goes into it. And owners, too. I think that's why you see people nowadays having, like, sort of stable secretaries or a stable assistant or office, whatever they call them. You know, there's lots of people that do that. And that keeps people in the loop. You know, my loop's my iPhone sitting next to me. That's, you know, I'm pretty good about calling owners all the time and just touching base. But I hope I have that problem of needing somebody like that. Maybe the future is syndicates, maybe. And when you do that, it's impossible to talk to 50 guys about one horse when you can have an email sent out that's got a video. And these guys that do syndicates now are great. Man, they're on the ball. They've got, when it comes to selling a horse or they've got one in a big race, they promote it. And it, you know, if you've got 40 people that own a horse and everybody brings a friend, I mean, heck, that's quite a few people that come to the races. And it's, nowadays, you've got real good opportunities to sit up the stairs and some suites, and Monmouth has a good suite program up there and Gulfstream as well. So it's fun for people to go to the races, especially if you've got something to root for.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about this game is that you can share it with your friends, and you know, you can be there with them when these special moments happen. Like you talked about earlier, when Fat Man won the Fred Hooper this weekend, you had a whole bunch of people with you. It's cool to celebrate like that, isn't it?
Oh, people that make a lot of money that are real successful in business, I wonder how often they get to high-five somebody, you know, and really, really mean it. Like, give them a real hard high-five and mean it, or a bear hug. You know, they can make money in a deal, or they can sell this or sell that, but I think there's nothing like two grown men hugging in a crowd full of people, so. It was a lot of fun for us. And like I said, these guys that own this horse are my buddies. All of them, they're my crew. And it was really, really fun to win for them. Maybe you know, I've got people that don't come to the races often, or they, you know, you got three or four, and it's a business for them, and this and that. They bred them, but when you get people like this who didn't know each other 2 hours before, and they're hugging and exchanging numbers, and they had a group text going, it was great. So I think that's one of the things that a lot of people miss out on in racing, is that's where Bradley Wiseford's so good. Look what he does. He puts people together, and they have fun. You know, individually, they're nothing, but together, they're unstoppable. So it's really, really cool, and I hope that's the future, and I hope we can get some people like that in with us, because that's what we're looking for, too. You know, we work really, really hard for it, and like I said, having to get in the car and be disappointed is tough enough, and at least win, lose, or draw, if people can have fun, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up, too, because a few weeks ago, trainer Scott Acker was on the program with me, and I asked him if he could spend the day with one trainer and learn from that trainer for one day, who would it be? And he said, Dwayne Lucas. And I followed that up and said, well, what one question would you want to ask Wayne if you could only ask him one? And he paused for a second and he said, how do you deal with the losing? How do you deal with losing, you know, the 80%, like you just mentioned? And I thought that was a really interesting take. So I'll ask you, how do you deal with the losing, Kent?
I think it's me. Yeah, for sure. We're used to losing to a certain extent. You know, we're almost expected to lose because there's 10 in a race and not everybody can win. So the odds are up against you to start with. But what about coming back to the barn and these guys have their heads down? I hate that. You know, they walk around, they've worked really hard, they ice this horse every day, he's a real pain in the butt to train, or this and that, or he bites, or, you know, and they put so much into it and come back and they're just exhausted because they've worked hard and the horse didn't run very good. It's disappointing, but if I can lead them a little bit and show that, man, don't worry, that horse ran really good, or oh, that was a bad ride, we'll get him next time. Something as simple as that, I think, keeps everybody's spirits up. And equally, when you do win a race, that you don't just pat the guy on the back or shake his hand. They put a lot into it, man, you know, and if you act like it means nothing, then it means nothing to them too. So I think equally, when you lose a race, you got to come back and pump them back up a little bit. And the horse, too. You know, I think to a certain extent, horses know they get beat. And, you know, you got one that ran their eyeballs out. By, you know, they've got dirt in their face and they've lost a shoe and they're down in the dumps, too. So that's one thing Jimmy always said was, don't let the horse know anything's going on. You know, before a big race, you try to keep them quiet. Don't show any kind of nerves around them. And horses can feed off that. And I think he's right. He is right. And the guys are the same way. It's equally as important to keep their spirits up. Very quickly, you can get into a slump. And I think, you know, we talked about the other day with somebody about, you know, you've got to keep showing up, keep going to the races, keep you know, talking to people. And even when you get down a little bit, you still got to go to work the next day. People are still paying you to take care of their horses, so you better get your butt up to work.
Visiting with trainer Kent Sweezy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to get to a short commercial break. We'll come back with the second half of the show. We'll talk to Kent about his time with Owen Hardy, his time with Jimmy Jerkins and Christoph Clement, learning from those legends and what he's applying to his business now that's making him so successful. Stay with me. It's Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. The Fasig Tipton Gulfstream sale is hotter than ever. The nation's premier two-year-olds in training sale is now accepting nominations for the 2020 sale. In 2019, the sale recorded a record average, record median, and sold more horses for $1 million or more than any other two-year-old sale in North America, including a $3.65 million sale topper that was the most expensive two-year-old sold in North America since 2006. Nominate today, the Fasig Tipton Gulfstream sale, April 1st, 2020, at Gulfstream Park. Where will you be?
Bloom Racing. Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Pulling away from Come Dancing, Mopetism, and the others, Midnight Bizou leaves no doubt today. She won the FIPS in hand.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now, get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
time-tested Broken Vow continues to deliver quality black-type stakes horses at a 15% clip. The top son of Unbridled has sired over 150 black-type horses, 80 black-type winners, and over $75 million in earnings. Among the 12 black-type horses sired by Broken Vow in 2019 was dual Canadian Classic winner Tone Broke, winner of classic races on dirt and turf. Also the sire of Imprimis, the Speedy Keeneland graded stakes winner of over $440,000. Give your mare a great start with a proven sire, Broken Vow, standing at Pin Oak Stud.
Make Woodbine the place to train and race your thoroughbred in 2020. The Woodbine Backstretch is equipped with a 1 mile dirt training track and a 7 furlong turf training track. Racing surfaces include a 1 mile all weather Tapeta main track, a 7 furlong inner turf course, and the 1.5 mile EP Taylor turf course. Opening day is April 18th, the Queen's Plate June 27th, Woodbine Mile Weekend September 19th and 20th, and the Pattison Canadian International, now a $1 million purse, on Sunday, October 19th. Visit woodbine.com/incentives for the full stake schedule and more information.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Ryder Ortiz Jr. looks to get to the clear with Fat Man. The back markers have certainly had pace ahead of them. They try to run home with Chewing Gum down inside. A gap of two to Olympic Village, and trying to run home from the back is Grey Magician, and they're at the top of the stretch. It's Zenden who is still in front. 3/4, 109-2, Zenden tackled by the Fat Man. Here comes Fat Man on the outside, and the Fat Man now to take the lead. Zenden is back to second, but in the Hooper, they couldn't stay with the Fat Man. It's the Fat Man to win by a length for Kent Sweezy. Zenden was second. Rare Forms in a picture with Chewing Gum for third, and then it was Grey Magician in 135-4.
What a fun call by Pete Aiello. That was last week at Gulfstream Park, the Grade 3 Fred W. Hooper going to the Fat Man, or Fat Man is actually his name, and he defeats everybody else, and he gives trainer Kent Sweezy, who is my special guest on Trainer Talk, his first graded stakes victory. A huge, huge afternoon. You heard about that in the first half of the program. We'll continue this conversation with Kent right after I do welcome everybody back to the program and remind you that if you missed any portion of this show, simply head back over to our website. That's horseracingradio.net. You can listen to this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. They are listed for you in order. Flip back through and hear the stories of so many of the top trainers in the sport today. They are fascinating, as this visit has been with Kent Sweezy. Kent, you know, you hear that race call. I don't know if you've had a chance to go back. I'm sure you've watched the replay, but you hear it on radio now. What goes through your mind when you hear that call?
When he said you can't outrun a Fat Man. Pete Aiello is the best at that, isn't he? He makes races every race. Like people always say, he makes a cheap maiden at Gulfstream equally as exciting as a graded stake. And I think that's very good attribute for him.
When you were with Jimmy Jerkins and Owen Hardy and Christoph, you had the privilege to be around some really, really top-notch horses. Names like Shaman Ghost and FNX and Wicked Strong, VE Day, all those horses come to mind immediately. Being around good horses when you were an assistant, has that helped you now that you transitioned into doing this on your own?
Yeah, I think so. I think when I talked to you maybe last year, a couple years back, it was the same kind of thing. You know, you just get a chance to know maybe what not to do, how to handle yourself, what to do when you do have a good horse. And the difference is that a lot of the bigger stables now have so many horses that they, number one, they don't appreciate that they have, you know, what they've got, because how hard it is to get a good horse, and they might not appreciate it. But again, that I had to start out when I worked for Jimmy, we had good horses. So if the horse, for example, had a little minor injury, Jimmy was very quick to stop on it and turn it out and give it time and let it come back around on its own time. When we're playing the game of the claiming game, I'm seeing things and different qualities about horses that I might not have seen before. And so the first couple years, you know, I bet when we started, I probably stopped on horses or turned horses away because I couldn't fix them, or I didn't know what I had learned wasn't working on these horses, because they're just different. It's different style of training, those horses. You know, they don't need claiming horses. They don't maybe need the miles underneath them that maybe a two turn dirt horse does. So I learned, I'd say pretty quickly, kind of the sink or swim model of of how to take care of them and how to get them back to the races and what keeps them happy. But the bottom line is, like I said, about keeping them happy, it's the same thing goes for a good horse. You know, look at Fat Man. I don't know what we did with Fat Man to make him so much better, but he's much better. You know, I don't know what it is, but maybe he's happier. Maybe he likes the groom or likes going on ice every day or likes whatever, you know, the shoe job he's got. And so that same theory applies to cheaper horses too. You know, you just got to get them happy and maybe they'll run harder for you. And whether you push on them harder or you back off on them, everybody trains a little bit differently. So some person's training might work on a horse and others might not. And it makes you think how many good horses were out there that got messed up before they got into somebody's hands, you know? And,
yeah.
You know, it makes you think a little bit. But I think the bottom line is keeping the horses happy and they'll, I mean, even if they're a tiny bit, I'd rather have a horse going into a race feeling good, happy, healthy, and maybe lack a tiny bit of fitness than to have overtrained on them and they've got a tiny bit of hesitation about wanting to lay it on the line. At least you know if the horse is good enough and it's in the right spot. If it's happy, it should run real good. If they're not doing great or their coat doesn't look good or they didn't eat up, well, you can run them in whatever spot you want to and they're not going to run any good, you know.
Yeah. Other than Christoph Owen and Jimmy, who are some of the other trainers, or are there other trainers that have had an impact and an influence on your career?
Yeah, definitely. My stepmother trained horses when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I did. I think she always, I don't think I even remember it. I used to set feed tubs, and I'd love to go through each feed tub and put the electrolytes and this medicine. And I, growing up on the farm, I learned a lot of important lessons just about horsemanship, not so much about training. You know, when I got to the racetrack, I would have never saddled up a racehorse. There was equipment on these horses that I'd never seen before. And it took me a long time to be comfortable to not being a rider myself, probably limited my ability, my knowledge of different equipment and things. You know, people that grew up doing pony club and have ridden since they were a kid, and I rode as a kid too, but we just threw the saddle on and went riding around a field. And so people that ride horses, they might be familiar with why this bit works, why this piece of equipment works. And luckily enough, I working for Christoph to start, he had some of the best riders. He had a lot of European riders that would come over, and the Europeans are very good horsemen on the whole. So I learned a lot from their riders and asking questions. And I'm sure I pissed them off and drove them crazy asking all the questions about what's this do, what's that do, what does this do, why are you doing that? You know, you hate having that kid asking all those questions. But I think I picked up on a lot. And then working for Jimmy, I mean, when you think you know equipment, go walk into Jimmy Jerk in the stack room. You'll see some stuff you've never seen before and stuff that came from his dad that his dad used. And so it's just, I didn't, you know, I can't say there's one person I learned from more than another. I watch what I'm doing. I watch all the, I stand outside here at the Gap and watch horses train all morning long. And I don't know, I think I kind of know some of the horses better than others that aren't mine, you know, that I say, wow, that's that good horse. I see Imperial Hint. And that Louis Carvajal's done a heck of a job with him. I watched him train all year. The last couple of years, I've watched him train. Maximum Security at Monmouth was so cool to watch Jason Servais work his magic on that horse. I mean, he had everything up against him, and to go and he just, he's a just what a war horse, what a cool horse. He lays it on the line. I like that. A speed horse that carries it. That's our kind of horse. So I watched him train a lot. Everybody's different. You know, there's not one trainer that trains just like another, and I think that's pretty cool, because you know one thing might work for one that doesn't work for the next, and if you pay attention and use what you've been taught, I think you got a good shot.
Yeah, so with all of those trainers and all of those different ideas and ideologies kind of mixed together to create a recipe that's worked for Kent Sweezy, how do you describe your training philosophy and your approach to training racehorses?
I'd say it's a lot like Jimmy Jerkins, to be honest with you. You know, we have a set list. Oh, sorry, this is a big trick driving past here. I have a set list, a board that's outside my office that has all the horses' names, and they're put on magnets, so I can switch the magnets around, the riders, what sets they go in, and if you walk in the morning, you wouldn't know what horse is going to do what, and because everything is going to determine on how, you know, what the track's like, what time of day it is, what they're going to do. you know, if they're going to go out and they're going to have a nice strong gallop because they're bouncing around the barn after a couple days of easy days. So we're going to give you a nice strong gallop today. And knowing when a horse is in a race, you're going to change what you're going to do by the distance, the post position, and how they act in the paddock. If you need to train them the day of the race, or you need to walk them, or if you, you know, you need to put cotton in their ears or not. And now there's so many different things that go into it that if somebody's not here to do that, to make those decisions, it turns into a factory. And I don't think that's, I hope that's why people don't have horses with me, because it's a factory. I hope they think that we're personalizing them and treating every horse like an individual. And I don't know, we take our time with a lot of the younger horses. You know, we didn't win many races with 2-year-olds this year because they all stuck around, and then we've eased them into it. And they're all back again for their 3-year-old year instead of just thinking, well, too bad that horse got hurt. Well, horses are going to get hurt. That's part of being an athlete. You know, I've sprained ankles, broken wrists, and all that stuff too. So, if you can limit your mistakes, I think it's probably the most important thing. And to try to, when you think something, and your gut tells you to do something, stick with it. And one thing Jimmy always said was, if you got something to think real hard about, just go sit by yourself and just kind of weigh it out. Just take a deep breath, and a lot of thought goes into what we do. And I think hopefully I say the harder you work, the luckier you get type of thing. So I try not to worry, but I am kind of a worrier. So
are you really?
I put enough stress on myself too.
Yeah, are you really? You worry a lot about constantly about the horses and the people and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, because what if I schooled him and didn't need to? What if he got all G'd up on Friday afternoon and leave some feet on Saturday morning because we overschooled him, or he didn't need to school, or he didn't need to gallop, but I galloped it because it was Pegasus Day and I wanted to have my horse out there galloping. Well, no, that's not what he needs. So, I mean, I make those decisions, and ultimately I think I'm the first and last decision, I guess. And I don't know. I think that's what wins some races for us, is doing things that other people might not do, and try to outthink the horse a little bit, and hope that keeping him happy, and, you know, I don't know, I think getting horses out in the afternoon helps a lot. You get to see him more, you get to know your horses a bit more, you can pick up on things that you wouldn't if they just sit in the stall. But you know, talking to your riders is really important. You know, that's something that plays a lot into what we do. If the horse is getting too strong for a kid, well, either we've got to change the equipment or change the rider. It's not to hurt your feelings. We're just trying to be on the same team here. You know, if you're playing with LeBron James, you're not going to average 25 points a night. I'm sorry. But you're going to win championships. And I think that's what I hope the goal in the end is, that we're all on the same team, that we're in it together. And if the barn succeeds, so do the employees, and hopefully the owners do too.
Being a Kentucky kid, Kent, how important and impactful would it be for you to win the Kentucky Derby? Is that something that's always on your mind?
Yeah, of course. The 2-year-olds are cool to get in because you start dreaming a little bit. And I don't know, I had a nice 3-year-old that just turned 3, and he ran second in a nice maiden to a pretty decent horse. And, you know, the first thing you think of is, where is he going to be in a couple months? Is he going to develop the right way? And can he just break his maiden? Just go out there and break your maiden like a good horse. And so we got something to dream about a little bit. But again, that's what it's all about. That's why these people bought Fat Man, was to dream a little bit, to be able to bounce ideas around and say, man, wouldn't it be cool to do this? And, you know, sure, it would be nice if he could take us someplace cool. Nobody ever, it's like, well, maybe with Harry Potter, it's a name that nobody says. You know, you never say Derby. You know, you sure think it, but you can never say Derby. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't have the stock this year to go anywhere close to it, but I think, you know, and that's why buying yearlings is so important, I think, because it can come from anywhere. You know, you see every single year horses are sold at auctions. So chances are, myself and other trainers, we've seen those horses at those sales. You know, there must have been an underbidder on every Derby winner. So, you know, how does that underbidder feel, that they could have gone 5 more thousand and gotten Derby winner? Well, that's not the case, but, you know, it's what everybody thinks about, and it's the ultimate goal, I guess. So, we'll see. I got a lot of maidens to break and some allowances to win in the meantime, but we sure wouldn't turn one down if it knocked on the door.
Yeah, that's a great point. Talking with trainer Kent Sweezy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't forget, if you miss any of the show, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast and follow us on social media at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook, and on Instagram. Kent, you spent time before you went out with your training career, you spent time working at Darby Dan Farm, where your dad served as the manager for many, many years. You spent time with your parents' Timbertown stable when they launched that business. And then you eventually went out on your own. What led to the decision to leave the farm life behind and say, hey, I want to move to the racetrack and train horses?
Well, the immediate answer is Christoph Clement. I mean, he came to the farm one day and asked what I was going to do. And I said, no, I'll just hang around here and work on the farm. So my stepmother, Kathy, had always raved about how much fun they used to have at Payson. And as a kid, you know, she's not going to, I didn't know anything about the surface of the track or how nice it is at Payson. It was always just how much fun Payson was. It was a great place to go for the winter. You know, got you out of the cold, you play some beach volleyball, you meet some people, it'll be fun for a couple months. So I did it, and I did that for 3 months for Christoph for I guess it would have been 6 months for the winter. And then it was kind of the point where, do I go back to the farm or go back to New York with Christoph? And I said, well, I'm having a really good time, probably having too much fun. And I met a lot of really cool people, and that's one thing about the racetrack. How many horses are stabled in one area? A ton. You know, so you've got all these different people, whether they're assistants or foremen or riders, or people around the track that, you know, it's a little bit of a racetrack family. It's a big racetrack family is what it is. I mean, we can't tell you how many holidays I've spent with people that I've got no relation to, you know. And that's the racetrack, and that's the ups and downs of it. But that's what got me started, was going to Payson with Christoph. And Christoph had good horses that year, man. We had Giaponte. We had, you know, some horses that I took care of that in my little small quadrant of the barn that I was the foreman to, we won some races out of it. You know, I couldn't even tell you what I didn't even know how to look a horse up then. I couldn't tell you how to get on Equibase. I just showed up every day and worked real hard. And I think that was probably the coolest thing, was to, I never got to go to the races, but it was nice to see our horses cheering them on from the office back at Payson. And it was really cool because Christoph works hard too, you know, and it's nice to see, you know, your hard work pay off, I suppose. So that was what got me started. And then once I left Christoph, I knew I needed to go someplace and keep doing the racetrack thing. That was my thing. I at that point I'd said, well, I want to try this training horse business. So, sure enough, went to work for Owen for a couple of years, and that was good to get out in California because I got to meet those guys and see what racing in Southern California was like, and it was fantastic. And but again, if I wanted to train on my own, I knew I had a better opportunity to do it on the East Coast because it's like coming back home. So that was the idea as well when I left Jimmy, was to go back home, you know, that I was going to try it at Keeneland and try it at Churchill and be able to sort of, you know, you can stay there for quite a bit longer. Then when you leave Monmouth, you got to leave pretty early. When you left New York, you had to leave early because the weather made you push you out. So getting down there in Kentucky, you could stay for almost an extra month and maybe come back an extra month earlier. So that made the most sense to me, to try to maybe have a family and do all that jazz, but didn't work out that way. But we're happy we're at Monmouth for sure.
When you were at Darby Dan, did John Phillips ever let you hold the World Series trophy?
I'd say so. I mean, if you got inks, I probably would have dropped it. But I remember walking through there, and I've been very close with John Phillips for a long time. And he was the first one standing outside the winner's circle at Gulfstream the other day to give me a big hug. And he's a big supporter, and I'm happy to I've learned all those lessons at Darby Dan under him. You know, I learned so much from him in an office, from talking about pedigrees to his racehorses, and not to mention that, you know, he hired good people and had good people working there. So it was a place I got to learn all sort of the basic lessons of horsemanship. My dad taught me from day one that, you know, just about the horse, how to lead one, how to take care of it. It's not rocket science. It's just keep doing the same thing over and over again. So it was a good experience being at Darby Dan.
Yeah, I remember meeting John for the first time back in the mid to late 90s when I was working at Thoroughbred Times, one of my first jobs in the business, and had a chance to go out to Darby Dan, and he quickly found out that I was a big Pittsburgh Steelers fan. So when he had a chance to show me the Pittsburgh Pirates World Series trophy out there, it was quite a thrill. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, big time, big time.
Yeah. You mentioned working with Owen Hardy on the West Coast for a time. Is there a difference in training horses out west as opposed to doing something different with them back east? Are there some philosophical differences?
I think the speed is such a major factor out there. At least it was when we were out there. But again, like those couple of years we were out there, was I'll Have Another won the Derby, you had California Chrome, and it was American Pharoah, then Justify. It just seems like some of the best horses go out west. But you wonder about the rest of the population. You know, you always wonder how the smaller middle level claimers are going to do out there, and are there enough horses to keep it going? And apparently it has. And as long as things stay good out there, I hope Racing California doesn't stop for a long, long time. It's a great place to live. You know, you can actually stay and you can raise a family, and I think that plays a lot into the people that you can have working for you, because you have some grooms that can live outside and have lives, and their kids go to schools and that type of thing. And we're moving around. This is the life of gypsies. You know, you're someplace for 6 months and you up and you pack up and you leave again. So that was a huge advantage of California, and why I saw those guys that their life did not revolve around Barn 27. You know, it was, they had a family and they had a wife, and they could go 6 weeks to Del Mar, but come right back home. And I think that that's one thing that we wish we had more of on the East Coast, is a better chance of staying in one place. But we're working on it. We're getting there. We'll see.
Yeah, you know, Kent, you're a young guy. You're, what did I say, 34, I guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, racing always talks about appealing to that younger demographic, and you're there. What can racing do? When you look at racing, when you talk to people in your travels all over the country and you talk to people that come to the races, what are some things that you see that could be done to kind of appeal to a younger group and get people interested in the sport?
I think I'm on Twitter. I like being on Twitter. Twitter's my news source in a lot of ways. And you see, you know, people talk about what are some things racing can fix and this and that. I think overall it's probably try to get everybody just to work together would be a main thing. But the simple things, like, you know, I mean, I don't know how much it costs to print out a program. But, you know, if you cut the program down to the information that people actually need, or you give something away, whether it's free parking or a free program, I don't mean hats or T-shirts, but, you know, you're getting the people out to the average fan to be able to afford to do it. I mean, most people that come to the races, you have different reasons why they come. Maybe they're a gambler, or they love horses, or they just want to come out and see the majesty of it, or they think the sport of it is fun. You know, how many people can afford to own a NASCAR, or to own a football team? You know, so to be able to be the owner of a horse, you could do that for not much money. You know, and not that this is cheap, but it's for a lot of people that do it, they go in at such a level that they're already at a disadvantage. So from an owner's standpoint, you know, if I have a new owner coming to me, I'd rather say, man, let's go out and claim something and win you a race, and then see if you like it, if you have fun, and bring your friends and your family and do that a couple of times, and then have some money in your pocket to go buy a yearling. But from a better standpoint, I think you gotta have you know, we talked the other day about weighing the horses at Gulfstream. You know, I knew Fat Man. He gained something like 29 pounds from the Harland Holiday to the Fred Hooper, and I breezed him really hard, three really good breezes, and he gained weight coming out of it. So it was, that to me is like, is the most important thing of a horse is how their weight, how their health is. And if you can give that information, and it costs basically nothing, and that's a huge thing. You know, I knew right away how good I knew he was doing good in my mind, but I couldn't tell how much he was weighing and how he, you know, exactly that. But that to me is about as important as knowing if a horse is on Lasix, or if how they're going to run on Lasix and things like that. And the future is probably running horses on no Lasix, but how did the horses come out of the Pegasus? You know, did they bleed coming out of the Pegasus? Because if they go run in Saudi Arabia, well, I'd like to know if we can bet them or not. You know, if they go run in Dubai, are they going to, if they bled, are they going to need a couple weeks off? And I think that's a transparency thing that a lot of people are hesitant to give out. But the bottom line is, you know, you're betting sports, and you've got so much information on betting football, right? You've got the spreads and the percentages and this and the overs, under, and all that stuff, the matchups. Well, then let's get these guys a fair chance at it too. You know, why, if you're going to go bet $100, well, I'd rather go bet something that I've got a lot of information on than something that I only have a small little PP for, you know? So people are spending the same amount of money, and the payouts are great. You know, betting horses, I love betting horses more than I like betting sports, you know, but I know a lot more about it because I'm informed. you know, if you inform people, they'd make a better decision, I think.
Yeah, and you bring up the Lasix thing, and that's going to be a hot button has been a hot button topic. It will continue to be for many, many months. Where do you fall on that argument?
We have a lot of two-year-olds that don't run on Lasix. I think a lot of it has to do with how hard they're pushed early, you know, and when you have I'd like to know the percentages of horses that bleed that went through a two-year-old sale or would have been raised differently or if they're treated differently pre-race wise, but that's all important moving forward and knowing what horses can do and what they can't. Maybe you say graded stakes races won't have Lasix one day. I don't know. But if that's the case, then there'll be a lot of horses that right now can't compete, but yet a stallion like Run Happy, who's advertised as being medication free, well, he's going to stand for $1 million here soon if that's the case. If he's the only stud out there that can run without medication, which I'm sure he's not, but he's the only one that we've seen in a long time that's been advertised without medication, then his book should be full 10 times over, because the rest of these horses that are out here and they need the medication because they're physically they're unsound or they've been bred that way or however it's going to be. But I think if that's the future, then we need to start planning accordingly with the way that they breed, I suppose. If I'm breeding a mare right now and I'm thinking down the road that the horse won't wear Lasix, well, I wish I had information to know what stallions did and what stallions didn't. You know, if I want to breed a turf horse, I can look up a pedigree on a horse that's a dirt. I'm not going to breed a dirt horse to a dirt horse and hope for a turf horse. If I have a bleeder to a bleeder, well, you know, that's not rocket science. So if I think, you know, horses are going to become more valuable, so much more valuable if you have a graded stakes winning mare that didn't run on Lasix and ran on no medication, it was hard knock and filly. You know, those are the ones that are going to be, you want to breed out of. I think that might be the future. But in the short term, we probably have to start trying it. And I think when a horse goes just for a first time starter to get Lasix, well, when did it first bleed? Is it bleeding now? Are you preventing it, or are you preventing it because you know that it bled in the past? So it all depends. And I think the harder you push on them, maybe the more they're going to bleed. The horses, you know, if you and I have a horse and your horse is on Lasix and mine's not, well, your horse might win first time, but how are you going to come back out of that race? You know, it might take you 2 weeks to recover because you got dumped a bunch of Lasix in your system where I didn't. So next time we run back in 3 weeks, I'm probably going to be a couple lengths closer. And the third time we run, I'm probably going to beat you because you've been knocked out and I've been able to bounce back like nothing. It's amazing how much better horses bounce back with no Lasix. Oh, and I already taught me that one with the Godolphin and the Bill Kastner horses. You know, they wanted to try things. They were thinking about this 10 years ago. This isn't something these guys are just starting to think about now. You know, so we used to weigh them every time before and after a race, before and after a work, if they're on Lasix, if they're not. You know, and it does. We had a filly one time. I think she lost, I want to say it was like 75 pounds in a race. You know, and that's a lot of weight for a filly to get. A filly who's already probably a little finicky eater or this and that, you know, that really knocks them out. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting stuff. Kent Sweezy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fays at Tipton. Kent, we have about a minute left here in the program, so we're going to have to go ahead and wrap it up. But I want to let people know that they can follow you on social media at Sweezy K is your Twitter handle. That's SWEEZEYK. The way to keep in touch with you. And if they want to send you some horses, I know you'll be happy to have them do that too. But listen, really appreciate the visit. It's been great to hear your story. We could spend another hour easy, but got to wrap it up. So I appreciate it here, Kent. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Anytime. Coming back anytime. Good talking to you.
Yeah, all the best moving forward, too. Kent Sweezy here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Really, really smart trainer. Passionate trainer. And one of those new up-and-coming, if you want to look at them like that, a new generation of horse trainers coming into the sport. And my thanks to Kent Sweezy here tonight. Don't forget, if you missed any portion, head to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next week on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.